These are all in the newspapers, folks. You didn't read them, did you? You think this is all baloney. You don't know how to put two and two together. But that's our job here. We are the intelligence service. Our job is to accumulate tons of data and sift through it and analyze it. And we are always assembling two puzzles. One is the deception and one is the truth. And in the middle is a big box with a question mark on it. We read everything. We devour everything. We listen to everything. Nothing is hidden. These people are talking to you and you're not listening, and they know you will not listen.
Obsessive collection of data by the NSA and GCHQ. Everything from your shoe size to your religion. Sound familiar? Yes, it's just what Hitler was doing in the run-up to the Holocaust in the 1930s. And a massive dossier this week from public interest lawyers on British war crimes during the invasion and occupation of Iraq goes to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. It could mean long jail terms for senior British politicians. Not to mention Army Chiefs too, but hardly a whisper about it on the British London news. If nothing else, this should wake us up to the extent to which some of our news is being censored. Also, intercepting your post to plant spyware and bugs on your nice new laptop, reading all your text messages without a warrant, and also planting secret Wi-Fi data harvesting chips on computers that have never been connected even to the internet. Just more criminal excesses by the secret Stasi state. Plus, the 30th anniversary of the miners' strike here in Britain. We hear from the author of The Enemy Within, Seamus Milne. He was on George Galloway's Sputnik programme on Russian channel RT last weekend. His dad, Alastair, was the last decent director general back in the 1980s of the BBC. We also have musician Pink Floyder Roger Waters comparing the Israeli government to Nazi Germany. Why does he say that? But first, I'm joined on the phone line by US freelance writer and photographer Chris Bolin. Hi, Chris, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, can hear you fine. Now, first, tell us a bit about yourself. I know I first met you when you were virtually the only photographer back at the 2000 Bilderberg meeting in Brussels.
Right. I was a photojournalist for American Free Press and Spotlight before erstwhile, and I covered several Bilderberg meetings. You and we met, I remember, in Chantilly in France and also in Genval in Belgium, if I remember. And, that was my introduction to photojournalism, was working as a paparazzo photographer for American Free Press, covering the Bilderberg meetings. And then, in my first year as an investigative journalist, 9/11 happened, and being this immense historical moment in America, I turned my attention to that, and I've written several books about it called Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and then my articles, I wrote many, many articles, is in the second volume called Solving 9/11, The Original Articles.
But let's get back to the Bilderberg conference for a minute, Chris, sure. Because, just give us an idea of the sort of harassment you got, because I saw some of it as a paparazzo. You were snapping pictures of a lot of these Bilderberg bigwigs that many people, even today, have still maybe never heard of. By calling out their name, of course, they would think that it was one of their fans. They would turn around and you get a snap of them, and this really got their backs up, didn't it?
The incident I remember most clearly was the one in Belgium, in Genval, just outside Brussels. And they had lunch break on the first day. I remember there was a very small crowd of people, and you were there, and I was there as a photojournalist, paparazzo. And I remember about noon on the first day, second day, I think it was, George Soros came out arm in arm, basically, with Carl Bildt. And I walked along because
He was the Prime Minister of Sweden at the time.
He had been Prime Minister of Sweden, and he was Prime Minister of Sweden until the day that Estonia ship sank, October 1st. The ship sank in the end of September. He was Prime Minister until October 1st of 1994, and then he took on various roles as United Nations envoy to the Balkans. And so he played a major role in this dismemberment of the Balkans of Yugoslavia, and the infiltration or whatever happened there afterwards in Kosovo. And
okay, so that's Carl Bildt. But what happened to you?
Well, I took a picture of Carl Bildt and George Soros together, and Carl Bildt was standing there with the books in his arms like a schoolboy, and George Soros was casting a mean glance my direction, and just after I took that picture, I was approached by these thugs, and basically I had to hightail it to a local restaurant and to get away from them, and I was threatened by them, by these Bilderberg thugs, and that was basically the last snap that I got at that meeting, because I was persona non grata.
Okay. Now, also, where do you live? Tell us about your police harassment. I know there's been some of that over in the U.S. there.
Sure. Well, I'm living in Sweden now because after writing about 9/11, September 11th, and discovering that the official version, what the government was telling the people and the mass media was telling the people, was nothing but a pack of lies, I spent a lot of time in Europe. And went back to America to test the waters now and then, and found that it was still not safe. And in 2006, just after the discovery of thermite in the dust of the World Trade Center, which I was involved in this discovery, some undercover police came to my house and basically assaulted me and broke my arm and tasered me in front of my children and my wife, and then charged me with assaulting them. And that led to my going into exile, going back to Europe, and my wife is European, and we have been living in Sweden for the last 4 years, which is a pretty safe haven.
Now, tell us a bit about this thermite, for people that have never heard of it. Why was that such a significant discovery? Because it sounds to me as if that may have been the trigger for some action being taken against you, Chris.
You're absolutely right. The discovery of what was discovered in the dust of the World Trade Center by Professor Jones, Stephen E. Jones of Brigham Young University, we had done the evidence. We had found the evidence that there must be something like thermite involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center, because we had molten iron flowing off the towers and found in the basements of the destroyed towers. And then, after collecting 6 samples of dust from the World Trade Center, Professor Jones out in Utah found small chips of what looked to be a bilayered paint. And this bilayered paint was actually an active thermitic compound. So that when this little chips, these tiny chips of paint, looked like paint, when they were exposed to temperatures of 430 degrees Celsius, they detonated. They basically exploded with a huge amount of energy. And this is a sophisticated explosive which appears to have been painted on surfaces in the World Trade Center. And this is most likely what was responsible for the pulverization of the concrete floors and everything on them.
Well, if people have never heard of thermite, if you go back to the 1960s, the very first ever edition of the thriller series, well, it's a kind of comedy thriller series, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., that actually includes a whole scene about this new kind of explosive thermite. So it's been around for a while, Chris,
right.
but you've gone on since then to write this critique of 9/11, solving 9/11. Why do you think you've solved it?
Well, it's solving. It's still in the active phase. But the evidence that I have uncovered in the 11 years of research has gone a long way towards solving it. It's not solved yet, but we have found the footprints of the culprits, and furthermore, we have most importantly, we have seen how the how the cover-up has been done in America, the destruction of the evidence, and the people behind it.
Because okay, that's
such a crime. It's such a crime. It's the cover-up which really indicates who's responsible. Because when people are covering up a crime like that, they are involved in the commission of the
crime. Well, that's fascinating, because we had the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination, didn't we, at the tail end of last year, and some of the most fascinating documentaries, none of which actually was shown on British television, look at the way that the cover-up rolled out, and then you can start to see who it was actually involved in lying as part of the cover-up process. So, solving 9/11. Tell us one or two of the points that you're making in that book.
Well, what I found is that from the very beginning, I began to look at the hypothesis that it was an Israeli / Zionist crime, because the five dancing Israelis who were arrested in New Jersey on September 11th appeared to have prior knowledge. And then went back to Israel and admitted that they had basically prior knowledge.
Now, these guys were actually filming the collision into the World Trade Center. Is that right?
Yes,
have you got any evidence that they were actually filming that, or they were just random people, maybe tourists?
No. They were filming, and they were employees of an Israeli front company called Urban Moving Systems in Weehawken, New Jersey. And two of the five were actually active Israeli intelligence agents. And their names were on a database which was available to all United States law enforcement agencies.
But surely, Chris, all that really proves is maybe that the Israeli intelligence service had some idea that it might happen, and they put them there to see if it did. It doesn't actually lock them in with actually being part of the crime.
No. That's right. They went back to Israel, though, and the three that were not Mossad agents said that their mission had been to document the event. So they obviously had prior knowledge, and there are other indications of prior knowledge by the Israelis, like these instant messages that went out to people on the Odigo system. But working from the hypothesis that Israel had prior knowledge, that Israeli intelligence had prior knowledge, I began my investigation. And as my investigation developed over a period of years, what I found was that at every critical juncture of the 9/11 saga, or the cover-up, there was a Zionist agent or an Israeli making the key decisions. So that indicated that either the Israelis were involved in this complot and covering it up on behalf of Al Qaeda, or it was a false flag terrorism plot in which they were basically calling the shots and covering up to conceal the tracks of the Israelis.
Okay. Old Dave Broxford economist Martin Summers, I know you're part of the UK group Reinvestigate 9/11. What would you add to what Chris has already said that should inform us about how we see 9/11, the 9/11 attacks, whatever it is we're talking about, 12 years later?
Well, I'm glad to hear that we're not saying we've solved it. I agree that the Israelis look as if they have a very strong indication that they were involved.
What makes you say that?
Well, for exactly the same things that have been mentioned, the five is dancing Israelis. They were on television in Israel saying, we were there to document the event. We weren't doing anything suspicious. Now, that's ridiculous. You can't document an event unless you know it's going to happen. And they were picked up by law enforcement because they'd seem to be celebrating when the planes hit the World Trade Center. But I think what's really important from a Reinvestigate 9/11 in Britain point of view is lots of people are poring all over the details of this. I think the finding of the nanothermite is very important by Professor Jones and Niels Harrit from Copenhagen University as well was involved in that, I believe. But also this basic stuff, what happened to the United States Air Force, the biggest and most expensive air force on the planet? What happened to that? After all these years, we should surely have a straightforward explanation for what happened to them. And of course, the other big thing that most people out there in radio land or whatever, everywhere else don't really pick up on is the third building that collapsed, WTC 7. And if anybody's interested in that, they can just look it up on the internet. There it is, a third building collapsed, and of course no plane hit it. So the ludicrous theory about jet fuel causing buildings to be reduced to rubble and dust was obviously not the case in the case of Building 7. So although I think it's really good that people should look at all the detail, and those who've got the time and the integrity to look at all the detail, people should just remember basic things. What about the third building? What about the Air Force?
Chris, now what does this mean for you as a US citizen who's now living over in Sweden? I mean, how do you think that this has altered the pattern of events in the world and in the US particularly?
Oh, it has completely distorted our history. It has completely distorted our reality. I mean, the detention that I experienced just last weekend at Heathrow Airport and being deported or removed to Sweden on the flight the next morning, this is what it's all about. This Stasi state, what you talk about so brilliantly, that's what we have that's what we have gotten now in the United States and in Britain, maybe a few other countries, I don't know. Israel certainly has. We have gotten a Stasi state apparatus running our countries. So that when I flew from Sweden to Britain, you know, when that lady at immigration opened up her screen with my passport on the desk, red lights went flashing. You know, this guy does not pass.
Okay, tell us what happened. This was all last weekend, Chris, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Just take us through what happened and what reasons were given to you for not allowing you to enter Britain. Because what worries me is that our liberties are being taken away not by Al-Qaeda or by Islamic fanatics, but by some of our own people in our own system, our own police, law enforcement, and people like that.
Exactly. I mean, that's what the 9/11 agenda was. That's the backside, is that it cuts down the tree of liberty in Britain and America, so that we now live in Stasi type systems, much more advanced though than Stasi ever was. But what I did is I flew to London last Saturday, the 11th, because I was invited to be on Ken O'Keefe's show. He's got a Middle East show on the People's Voice Television, which is a David Icke production there in Wembley. And I flew in on Saturday to be on the show on Sunday, and I was going to stay until Wednesday because he wanted to do another interview on Wednesday, and I was going to fly back to Sweden on Wednesday afternoon. When I flew in on Saturday, though, I was detained for reasons that were not at all clear and held overnight, you know, in these lockup cells that they have, these TASCOR. It's a private company that does the lockup in Heathrow, and so I was held in this facility.
But surely they must have given you some sort of explanation as to what was going on, Chris.
Well, the first explanation was that she wanted to ask more questions from me, and she disappeared. I gave her the phone number for Ken O'Keefe because I said, you know, it's not the Schengen zone. So coming from Sweden, you have to, you know, you're entering Britain, which is not Schengen.
So do you have a Swedish or a U.S. passport?
A U.S. passport. I'm a Swedish resident. I'm a Swedish resident, long-term, you know, permanent resident with American passport. And so, but, you know, the databases are now shared to such a degree that when you come into an airport, they have all their messages right there on the screen in front of you, and the discussion is not with you, but with the computer screen in front of them. And so, you know, she said, she wanted to know Ken O'Keefe's, you know, his street address, exact street address. I only knew he was in Paddington someplace in London, and I gave her his phone number. So at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, she disappeared with the phone number to go, you know, presumably to give a call to him and find out, you know, the data.
Okay, before you carry on, can you just tell us a bit about Ken O'Keefe, because he's quite an interesting character.
Oh, absolutely. Ken O'Keefe is a brilliant character. He's an American who's burned his passport, an American Marine who served in the first Gulf War, who then, you know, from San Diego, who realized the inhumanity of the American-British, you know, war in Iraq. And so he then became involved in human rights, you know, first with whales and aqua animals in Hawaii and Washington State. And then he became involved in, like, 2003, trying to extend protection to the Iraqi people by putting Americans and British people out there as, like, you know, human targets, or what do you call it, like, to protect the human shields, to protect the people of Iraq. But then in 2010, he really came onto the screen when he participated in the Mava Marmara flotilla, the humanitarian flotilla to Gaza, and that was the flotilla where the Israelis attacked, they assaulted the ship, the Turkish ship, in international waters in the Mediterranean Sea before it got to Gaza. And in the process of assaulting the ship, they killed 9 people, One of them was a Turkish American. Other ones were Turks. But, you know, really, it was a very mean-spirited operation in which they killed people at point-blank range, executed people. And Ken O'Keefe was on that, and he was involved in, like, arresting two of the Israelis, which they didn't take very kindly to. And they took him back to Israel and treated him very roughly. And he's best known because he came out of there with his face all bloodied, having been assaulted by these Israelis and interrogated. And he didn't wash the blood off his face. He wanted the world to see what they had done to him.
Now, so what happened to you next to Heathrow Airport last weekend then,
yeah,
Chris?
Yeah, so I flew in and I did the passport thing and went through the customs and talked to the lady. And she was not satisfied at all. She, you know, she wanted to know how long I knew Ken O'Keefe and how I'd been invited and wanted to see the emails and this and that. Then she gave me a little piece of paper and said, "You are detained. I'm detaining your passport, and there will be further questions." Then she went back into the behind the glass windows, behind the reflective glass windows, and did not come back. And I was waiting out there for hours and hours and hours. And finally, you know, after some time, Metro Police came out and talked to me a little bit. Then another lady came out and offered me a cup of tea. And then I was put in detention. Then I was interrogated. I had a big, long, handwritten interrogation in which I had to sign each page. And then finally, about 9 o'clock at night, now this is like 8 hours after I have arrived at the airport, based on the interrogation they did at 8 o'clock, they then said that based on what you told us during the interrogation, that you have outstanding warrant for your arrest in Chicago, we are not letting you into Britain because you are a threat to public safety. And so it took them 8 hours to come to this, to concoct this reason. And then they said, you will be put on the next plane back to Sweden the following morning.
Okay, so what was this Chicago allegation about then, Chris?
Well, okay, the Chicago thing is that in 2006, I was attacked by undercover police at my house. And these undercover police broke my arm and tasered me in front of my wife and children. But after having attacked me, they then charged me with assaulting them and resisting their arrest, although they were not wearing uniforms and had not identified themselves as police. This is what we call the criminalization of an outspoken journalist. So you see, in this way, they criminalized me and made life difficult for me in America. My wife and we took our family to Europe in 2007 after the trial, and so see, this is how they can use this kind of criminalization to their benefit. They say, well, you're a criminal, Mr. Boleyn. You didn't go to sentencing, so you're therefore a risk to British public safety.
Now, tell us maybe one of the key points that you would have made on Ken O'Keefe's show, if you'd managed to make it, Chris, because ultimately what we need to know is, where is this all heading? And what is it that ties these three drone strike assassination powers together, Britain, the United States and Israel?
Yeah, well, the thing is that the show has been produced. The show is online. And I'll be putting up the link to the archived show. I had a big hand in producing the show because I was the editor. I edited. Ken sent me the script, and I, you know, made some corrections. And
can you tell us now what will be on there? Just give us a sneak preview.
Yeah. Well, basically that it's the layout of the 9/11 crime. That it is a false flag crime, and that it was very much. An Israeli-conducted operation in order to create the war on terror with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
But where is this all heading now? Because we've just had a load of stuff this week. More and more people being killed in Iraq. The Middle East is turning into a terror zone. You know, you've got all this civil war going on in Syria. Where is it all heading? Just project this into the future a bit, Chris, and give us an insight.
Well, if the Israelis and the Zionists get away with their agenda, it will mean the division of these countries into sectarian zones. Iraq, for example, into a Sunni and a Shiite sector with a Kurdish sector in the north, or Syria breaking up into similar sections, exactly like they did in Yugoslavia. That's if the Zionists get their way. They seem to be getting their way pretty much because they are able to do these kinds of bombings and to foment the kind of sectarian divisions that they have fomented.
Well, hang on a minute, because what's your problem with Zionism? This is a perfectly legitimate movement. It was created in the last century to give a homeland to Jewish people.
Right, right. All very good, but when they are not accepted in the region, because of their warmongering. And then when they went, what they seek to do is, because they have created a Jewish state, so-called Jewish state in Palestine, what they intend to do is to weaken the entire region by creating similar ethnic states. And that means breaking up the larger countries like Iraq and Syria into similar ethnic statelets, just like Yugoslavia, so that you would wind up with a Middle East full of very weak ethnic states that would not be able to oppose Israel either on an ideological basis or in any other way.
Okay. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, before we say goodbye to Chris, can you just give us your view on this, the whole sort of way that the policing seems to be going around the war on terror? Chris is an outspoken journalist, clearly not a terrorist. Why isn't he allowed to enter Britain? We're all now talking about certain people being treated as if they are some sort of terrorists by a Stasi state.
Yes, I think that's very clear. And I think the point about the Israelis as well, if we are right about this, and I suspect we are, they were behind the 9/11 attacks. Now, I would put it to ordinary Joe Sixpacks out there in the US and ordinary people here. How acceptable is it for 3,000 plus civilians to be killed by an enemy state like that? That is war, if you're going to do that. I mean, what happened with Serbia when they were chucking their weight about in the Balkans, and I was an aid worker over there during the war, what they said to Serbia is, you will withdraw from Kosovo or we're going to blast you to pieces. And they bombed them for, I think it was 40-some-odd days. They killed 10,000 people, and eventually the Serbs withdrew from Kosovo. Exactly the same sort of ultimatum needs to be made to the Israelis, because if they are allowed to foment a war, we will all be involved in it, and we can't allow that.
Well, anyway, from Sweden, thanks very much for joining us, Chris Bolin.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure being with you.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, we can count on to talk about the Stasi state, that's for sure, this week, because there's been a lot of news stories breaking about it. The National Security Agency infiltrated more than 100,000 offline computers, Martin, using covert devices, that leaks say. America's National Security Agency has been using secret technology to enter and alter data in computers, even when they're not connected to the internet, according to reporters from the New York Times. Documents given to the paper by the whistleblower and ex-NSA contractor Edward Snowden say the intelligence agency has infiltrated 100K computers worldwide, fitting them with secret devices. Now, I imagine if, for example, a computer goes in for servicing, a little secret device can be put on there, and then it's connected, whenever the computer is switched on, by some kind of wireless device to a secret device nearby to your home, where your contents of your hard drive are being harvested, basically being looked at. 100,000 of these computers, though.
Well, the first point to make is that there's no legal basis for any of this spying. And if things are not things that are being done are not legal, then they are illegal. And the simple answer to all of this is that all illegal spying, everybody involved in it, should be prosecuted, just like we prosecute people who steal bottles of water during riots, and we send them down for 2 years for stealing a bottle of water, because the law is the law. Now, it's absolutely clear that the NSA and GCHQ in Britain have broken the law. That means senior people, just like in the banking industry or anything else, they've got to be prosecuted and put in prison. Now, if that doesn't happen, we haven't got a rule of law. That's the first point to make. The second point to make, of course, is that the people doing the spying, we've just had a long conversation about what happened on 9/11. It isn't just 9/11. If you go back to Gladio in the 70s and the 80s, the Western intelligence services have got a track record of being terrorists, not just of overstepping the mark in attempting to control terrorism, but actually being the terrorists. And if you think where Al-Qaeda came from, it came from exactly that milieu. And in actual fact, the Israelis were involved in that, because they supplied a lot of the Russian-made weaponry, which they'd captured in Syria and elsewhere in Egypt, to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and it was all supplied to Al-Qaeda, set up under Operation Cyclone with MI6, our own intelligence service, in the lead as the lead agency. So it's not just a question that they are spying on us. The people spying on you are the terrorists. Now, what's the answer to all of this? The answer to all of this is the rule of law. And of course, if there is no rule of law, then we'll go back to how we were in the Irish situation a few years ago. There's no rule of law, then we'll sort it out another way. Now, what people have got to realise, if they're going to pursue this strategy, if there isn't going to be a rule of law, then there won't be one. I suggest that the strategy is that there should be a rule of law, and everybody who's been shown, I mean, perhaps we're going to come to the abuses in Iraq shortly, people who break the law, be they ever so mighty, and that includes prime ministers like Berlusconi, prime ministers like Cameron, and others, if you are shown to have broken the law, we expect you to be prosecuted. Otherwise, we'll go back to how we used to do it when two Tory prime ministers in this country were nearly executed by the IRA. And, of course, they had to shake the hands of those people at the end because there's nothing else to do. Now, if that's the kind of world you want to live in, that's where we're going to end up. And that, unfortunately, is the crossroads that we're at.
OK, well, we certainly will be talking about Iraq in a minute. But before that, the National Security Agency collects millions of text messages also daily in untargeted global sweep. A Dishfire program sweeps up pretty much everything it can. GCHQ are using a database to search metadata from UK numbers. I mean, looking at the slide on the Guardian website, Martin, it says that the work is funded by something called, weird organisation called the T1221 Centre for Content Extraction. Now, that content is your private messages between you and your mother, your father, well, people like this.
Interestingly enough, that because of all of this is broken, there's two major effects. One is that trade negotiations are breaking down because people won't negotiate with the Americans and the British if they think their communications are being spied on. And the other effect I've forgotten what the second effect is. That's the point is that they are losing control of this narrative. People need to realise what's happening. We have got a Stasi state. The answer is to put this all back under a rule of law. In other words, you've got to have a legitimate reason to target somebody, a legitimate suspicion. You can't just go fishing.
More than 110,000 names from electronic business cards also included in the ability to extract and save images, this Dishfire programme. More than 5 million missed call alerts, people that phoned you that you didn't get through to. One also wonders whether they're doing basically what the phone hackers were doing, which is listening to people's phone messages before they'd heard them themselves.
I'm just reminding myself of what my second point was. US internet companies, and the internet, of course, is a major money spinner for the US and for British companies as well, are losing business because nobody wants to buy their stuff if it's all been tampered with by.
But you haven't got a lot of choice, have you? Actually, you're being locked into the internet.
What's going to happen in the medium term is that lots of people all over the world, the Brazilians are about to set up their whole new internet setup, which is completely separate from the US setup. They've actually possibly killed the whole industry, because if people can't rely on it to be secret, they won't use it.
Well, we did have a little clip of this last week. We're going to have another little listen to it now. This is the thing that really bothers me more than anything about this, which is the use that the Nazis put the data, these databases, back in those days, they were punch card databases. They weren't on computers, because computers didn't exist, pretty much. But they certainly did keep databases right throughout Nazi Germany of people's things like their religious affiliations, their addresses, even silly things like their clothes sizes, and photographs. These kinds of things were kept. Databases on everybody. And a very good book was written about 15 years ago by a Jewish American called Edwin Black, called IBM and the Holocaust. So let's have another listen now to a bit from him and discuss it afterwards.
When I say the information age, I specifically mean the individualization of statistics. This leap across the labyrinth of human understanding occurred when the Hitler regime wanted not only to control its population, but to persecute its individual citizens. IBM knocked on their door. They said, "You have a problem. We have a solution." IBM is the solutions company. What I discovered was that there was no solution, that the solutions company was unwilling to formulate for the Third Reich. IBM was, of course, aware what the technology was being used for, because they had to ask not only what information was to go into a punch card application, but what information the Nazis wanted to bring out of it. By cross-tabulating 24,000 cards per hour, the Reich could quickly identify exactly how many Jews of Polish extraction were in Berlin. All of the Nazi atrocities were vastly headlined in the newspapers of the day, and so Thomas Watson was aware that Adolf Hitler was persecuting the Jews, stealing their assets, and getting them ready for the worst forms of physical destruction, even extermination. and Watson had promulgated the belief that people should disregard this, that this was just politics. And his idea was that it was never about the Nazism, the National Socialism. It was only about the money. And what he told people is, ignore the morality, go for the money. It was the almighty dollar. There is an almighty, and his name ain't Dollar.
Edwin Black there, talking about his book IBM and the Holocaust. The Guardian in 2002 commented on the paperback edition of his book, Martin. He said, they say that newly discovered documents from Hitler's Germany prove the computer company IBM directly supplied the Nazis with technology which was used to help transport millions of people to their deaths in concentration camps at Auschwitz and Treblinka, and a controversial Holocaust expert claims in a new edition of his book. Edwin Black, whose book IBM and the Holocaust was published in hardback last year, that's 2001, says new evidence set out in the paperback version shows executives from the firm's New York headquarters directly controlled a Polish subsidiary which leased the punch card machines used to calculate exactly how many Jews should be emptied out of the ghettos each day and transport them efficiently on railways leading to the camps. When the Nazis invaded Poland, Black wrote in the Jerusalem Post, IBM New York established a special new subsidiary called Watson Business Machines after its then president, Thomas Watson. IBM's new Polish company's sole purpose was to service Nazi occupation during the rape of Poland. Watson Business Machines even operated a punch card printing shop over the street of the Warsaw Ghetto, the paperback claims. The earlier edition of Black's book, the connection between the US headquarters and IBM and European operations was more sketchy. But the paperback provides the first hard evidence that the company's dealings with the Nazis were controlled from its New York headquarters throughout World War II.
Well, yes, and you could say, well, that's just mercenary behaviour. But in actual fact, of course, Prescott Bush, who was the grandfather of George W. Bush, was arrested during World War II by the Roosevelt administration for trading with the enemy, although he managed to get off. And he was very prominent financiers on Wall Street were very strong backers of Hitler, and their coordinator was Prescott Bush, who was also involved in an attempted coup against the Roosevelt government, which was in fact thwarted by General Smedley Butler, the retired head of the US Marine Corps. All of this is actually available, but you don't get Radio 4 documentaries about it. And of course, people have got to realise that the Western Intelligence Service in more recent times have a track record of engaging in terrorist activities. I keep repeating about this, but I'm going to repeat it again. Imposimato, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book that came out in 2012 accusing the NATO intelligence services of terrorism in Italy in the 70s and the 80s. And it's based upon 30 years of investigation by the Italian police force. And he was the investigating magistrate in the Moro case, for example. What ordinary folk have got to realise is that the secret state in the West, particularly in Britain and the United States, is way out of control. It needs to be put back under control. And I think we find that a lot of the terrorism problems that we claim to have would be resolved. But we've got to put them behind bars.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now on to another news story this week. The corruption of Britain is an amazing bit of work being done at the Independent at the moment by their new investigator. I think he's new anyway. Investigations reporter Tom Harper. The corruption of Britain, he says. The UK's key institutions have been infiltrated by criminals. Quite an incredible story. The entire criminal justice system was infiltrated by organised crime gangs, according to a secret Scotland Yard report leaked to The Independent. The 2003 Operation Tiberius found that men suspected of being Britain's most notorious criminals had compromised multiple agencies, including HM Revenue and Customs, the Crown Prosecution Service, the City of London Police and the Prison Service, as well as the pillars of the criminal justice system, including juries and the legal profession. Strategic intelligence scoping exercise was ratified by the most senior management of the Met and uncovered jurors being bought off or threatened to return not guilty verdicts, corrupt individuals working for Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, both in the UK and overseas, and, get this, get out of jail free cards being bought for £50,000. Martin, it does look like rather like a kind of banana republic when you've got you pay £50,000 to get out of jail in Britain. That's not justice.
Well, if you think back to the Stephen Lawrence affair, I used to live in South London at the time, and the word on the street was that the lads who'd done it were thinking they could get away with it because their father was one of those criminals which had bought the Metropolitan Police. That's just gossip, just rumour. I think people have got to face the fact that police officers at every level, and politicians, and bankers, and Secret Service people are corruptible. Not only are they corruptible, they are corrupted, and it's something you've got to expect because of the kind of world that they live in and the kind of things that they do. And when people go on about, oh, Britain's got the cleanest politics and the cleanest police in the world, I say phooey. The City of London is a sewer. It's a bigger sewer than Wall Street, and Britain is actually the heart of corruption. The main gangsters all over the world have all got their pads in London, and you know why? It's because this is where they come. Because we are, in fact, the place where this kind of thing happens.
Just
we've got to face up to it.
To carry on with this article, in 1998, police appeared to have finally made a breakthrough when Tommy Adams was jailed for more than 7 years for importing cannabis. However, the article cited by Tiberius states the only reason the Adams family allowed the prosecution to succeed, had not resorted to bribery or intimidation to thwart it, was because the other brothers wanted to teach Tommy a lesson for getting involved in crimes they had not authorised. The article concluded, witnesses terrified into silence, dodgy jurors, bent lawyers, bent policemen and bent Crown Prosecution Service clerks are all part of the same cancer, eating away at justice. A cure for the malady would not be easy to come by. Perhaps we should begin by acknowledging that the patient is sick.
Absolutely. We've got to face up to the fact, the level of corruption. I mean, frankly, the City of London, most of what goes on there is in fact criminal. We had Rowan Bosworth Davis on this show, former Met Fraud Squad officer, stating exactly that. Now, at some point, there's going to have to be a reckoning with this criminal overclass. These people who are in charge but are criminals, far more dangerous to the community than the criminal underclass. But they can be dealt with, they must be dealt with, and we've simply got to have a rule of law policy. A rule of law policy means that we will go to any lengths to catch particularly big criminals at the top. They're more important, far more important than the small criminals, and they must be seen to be punished, and that's what's got to happen.
Well,
the alternative is civil war.
Alistair Morgan is quoted in the article too in The Independent, and he's been on this programme. His brother Daniel was murdered in 1987 before he could expose links between Metropolitan Police officers and organised crime. He told The Independent, the police have no desire to tackle this. It would be too damaging to have it all aired in open court. The Met is a highly political organisation.
Yes, all of that may be true. That doesn't mean that we don't need a police force, but we need a police force which actually serves the community. And the police are in the same universe as bankers who steal, as secret services that are engaged in terrorism, and so on. Now, of course, it's a bit shocking for people to realise that the parents of our family, if you like, the people in charge, the people we're supposed to look up to, are in fact the criminals. But the sooner we face up to this reality, the better off we're all going to be.
Okay, another article in The Independent this week, also by Tom Harper, looks at the Masonic aspect to this Tiberius report. Secret networks of Freemasons, he said, have been used by organised crime gangs to corrupt the criminal justice system, according to this Tiberius report from 2002. It found underworld syndicates used their contacts in the controversial Brotherhood to recruit corrupt officers inside Scotland Yard, concluded it was one of the most difficult aspects of organised crime corruption to proof against. It found officers serving in East Ham, East London, were members of the Freemasons, attempted to find out which detectives were suspected of links to organised crime from other police sources who were also members of the society. Famous for secret handshakes, Freemasonry has long been suspected of having members who work in the criminal justice system, notably the judiciary and the police. Now, there was a big attempt to get everyone who was involved in this in the government to fess up. Chris Mullin's Home Affairs Select Committee back in 1997 and 1998, Martin, they recommended everybody involved in government, if they're a Freemason, should declare their membership. And then even the organisation that was supposed to enforce that, the Standards Board of England, was abolished by this government.
Quite. I think that what's increasingly becoming clear to people is that the political process is bought, and money talks. It doesn't just talk, it swears. And people who think that Britain is somehow immune from this kind of corruption and ultimately violence, because we're talking about terrorism as well as corruption, they're simply wrong. Britain is at the heart of a lot of what goes wrong in what's going wrong in the world, and it's our responsibility to do something about it.
Well, the establishment, and much political establishment, and much of the media often dismiss these ideas of as conspiracy theories. However, Operation Tiberius is the second secret police report released by the Independent in the last 6 months, they say, to highlight the possible issue. There was also Project Riverside, which was actually revealed first by Channel 4 News' Andy Davis. This is all a little bit concerning, particularly when you've got something which many people consider as a religious cult in some of these organisations.
Well, the Freemasonry will be used as propaganda duo was used in Italy.
What did it actually do, Propaganda Duo?
Propaganda Duo was a Freemason's lodge at the heart of the Italian state. It involves, you know, top secret police officers, top industrialists, and according to Imposimato, they were behind, and many of them were Bilderbergers, behind the terrorism in Italy in the 70s and the 80s. Now, of course, they've got an inquisitorial system in Italy, so Imposimato, as a magistrate, was able to get to the bottom of quite a lot of things. I mean, don't forget that these reports which have been leaked are police reports. So, in other words, we're not accusing all the police of being corrupt. Some police obviously know what their job is.
Actually,
they're pointing the finger.
Actually, Tiberius is a Scotland Yard report. Project Riverside is a serious organised crime agency report.
Yeah, but the point is, in other words, what needs to happen is that these reports need to be compiled by honest and honourable officers, and then they need to be acted on. And if they're not acted on, then we are going on a slippery slope towards civil war, because if people cannot believe or accept that the powers that be are above board, then they won't bother working through normal channels to settle their disputes. And one
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Okay, Iraq war crimes allegations go right to the top. Evidence of abuse by British forces in Iraq shows it was not down to a few bad apples of a few rogue soldiers, but was a systematic problem, according to Phil Shiner from Public Interest Lawyers. Martin, this is 2 years it's taken Public Interest Lawyers to compile this report. It's gone to The Hague, and there are various people being fingered as possibly having to go to jail as a result, including Tony Blair, also the head of the army, General Sir Peter Wall, ex-Defence Secretary Jeff Hoon, and former Defence Minister Adam Ingram.
Well, these are only allegations, but obviously since they've taken 2 years to assemble them, they've obviously done quite a good job of assembling them. The question for the International Criminal Court is, does it ever prosecute anybody that the West... other than the people that the West doesn't like.
Just to clarify, it's the cases of more than 400 Iraqis, thousands of allegations of mistreatment amounting to war crimes of torture, cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment, systematic.
Well, also murder, I believe, is involved in this. People, you know, people ended up dead as a result of their ill treatment. Now, I think people who want to have wars in other people's countries have got to pay the price for their decision. And if your military and senior officers and politicians are shown to be involved in torture and so on, then that's against the law, and those people will have to be punished. And of course, in Britain, we don't have the death penalty for murder. In the US, they do. And I think that the only way to get us back on to an even keel is everybody understands at every level of the structure that if you carry out an illegal act, then you will ultimately be prosecuted and imprisoned.
And we have had another bomb attack in Iraq this week. It's almost every week 100 people or so killed. The UN has given a report saying that there are about 8,000 civilians just last year killed in Iraq. I mean, this is far, far worse than anything that Saddam ever did.
Well, no, it's on the same level. Let's not get into the whataboutery. Was it worse or was it better? Don't forget, Saddam was put in power by the West in the first place, although most people won't remember that, and they weren't told at the time. The fact is that the ruling class in the West has become criminalised. And I use that word advisedly in the sense that they all have Interpol files. They all have police files. And you may think I'm exaggerating, but I don't think I am. And ultimately the solution is not just to vote them out. We should vote them out by all means. But if they've broken the law, they should be prosecuted and imprisoned, probably for life, because we're talking here about high-level corruption, murder and terrorism. You can't give a slap on the wrist for this stuff.
These accusations are all documented interviews, all made public by these people, public interest lawyers. Martin, ultimately, though, we've also heard this week that global media watchdogs are to investigate press freedom in the UK for the first time. Worried about press regulation here, saying that it's not working, and also that we've got far too much censorship in our press. Now, that's one of the things things I mentioned at the top of the hour is that these accusations are enormous. Britain is you know, stands to suffer massively internationally, and has in most other parts of the world where this has been reported, but it's not really been discussed properly here, certainly.
No, I mean, the media is another issue about, you know, what controls would be justifiable, whether they... The media mainly do their work through what Brian Eno, the pop star, calls propaganda. They tell us what we're supposed to worry about. So we're supposed to be worrying about people on benefits. We're not supposed to be worrying about corrupt police officers. That's not on the script. Now, in actual fact, the corruption at the top is far, far more damaging and far more important than the you know, the misdemeanors at the bottom. But of course, there's the media are bought and paid for by the criminals themselves. You know, we're looking at people who are actually criminals paying for owning newspapers, for example. No names being...
Well, we could mention Conrad Black, because he did go to jail,
well, indeed,
but that's the sort of person.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Now, 30 years after the miners' strike, Seamus Milne was on the George Galloway programme on RT Sputnik, explaining some of the aspects to what we now know what happened back in the 1980s.
Every year, the government releases cabinet and government papers from 30 years previously, and sometimes they do it a bit earlier nowadays as well. And sometimes, in fact, quite often, they don't release the papers at all because they're too embarrassing. And this year, they released a lot of stuff about 1984. That was 30 years ago, and about the miners' strike, which began in 1984 and went on for a year. And in those papers, there are certainly very important confirmations of things that had been widely suspected but not known for certain, like, for example, the fact that Thatcher had a plan to send in the army to keep coal stocks moving, because, and this is a very crucial point I think that's often misunderstood by people who were quite supportive of the miners at the time, which is that the strike came very close to succeeding on more than one occasion, and the government was in a panic that not only fuel supplies would run out and there would be blackouts, but that food supplies would run out. So that's one thing that comes out of it. Another thing that comes out of the papers is that it was said at the time by the miners' leadership, not just Arthur Scargill, but him in particular, that there was a secret hit list to close 75 coal mines. And that was denied by the coal board at the time, by the government. It was said to be an appalling lie by the miners' leadership. They were manipulating and misleading their followers. The media echoed all that. And of course, it's revealed that there was indeed such a hit list. There are other things besides confirmation that the government manipulated the media, that the security services, MI5 in particular, were heavily involved in operations against the strike, and, for example, that the government was planning to charge the miners' leaders, Arthur Scargill, personally, with incitement to riot, and they only pulled back from it because they realised it might make the situation worse. But I think what all that underlines is this was a mighty confrontation between the state and organised labour, in a form that really hadn't happened since the general strike in 1926 and certainly hasn't happened since. It was a watershed in modern British history. It was a battle not only about coal mines and fuel, and of course the arguments changed about that in the years since as climate change has become a crucial issue, but it was about how Britain is run and whether or not the market-led neoliberal model of capitalism, which has since been imposed on us, was going to be was going to run riot, which is of course what happened after the strike. So I think it is a very important part of British history, and it's one in which there are important lessons for us all to this day.
That's the Guardian's Seamus Milne there talking to George Galloway on his Sputnik show.
What's happening here is the more we dig, the more dirt we find. That's all we can say about this. And our path was set in that decade.
But what about its implications for coal energy now, for example?
All of that could have been discussed in a sensible tone of voice, but there was a determination to smash the miners because that was a way of undermining the labour movement in this country as a whole, and the coal industry was roadkill.
Okay, finally, Martin, tonight, former Pink Floyd frontman Roger Waters has compared the Israelis to the Nazis. This is from the Metro back in December. A 70-year-old was criticised by rabbis and Holocaust groups after he said in an interview on online magazine Counterpunch, actually very good website, Counterpunch excellent magazine, I would say. The parallels with what went on in the 1930s in Germany are so crushingly obvious. Waters, who supports a current boycott of Israel, said he would not have played France or Germany during World War II. He added, there were many people that pretended that the oppression of the Jews was not going on from 1933 until 1946. So this is not a new scenario, except that this time it's the Palestinian people who are being murdered. During the interview, he also described the Israeli rabbinate as bizarre and accused them of believing Palestinians were subhuman.
Well, I think that's fair comment. I would suggest that the treatment of the people in Gaza looks more like the Warsaw Ghetto than the Holocaust. But let's not get into whataboutery. Basically, whether people are Jews, non-Jews, Gentiles, whatever, everybody deserves decent treatment.
OK, Martin, thank you. Time to sign off now. Not sure if Cyrus the Virus is going to be around after our show, but hopefully he's on afterwards. Anyway, thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor for Bishopston Ward, Daniela Radici. Also to Chris Bolin, phoned in from Sweden. And, of course, to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We're online at www.thisweek.org.uk. See you next week.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, police say the disappearance of three-year-old Mikhail Kular may have been the result of a criminal act. The toddler was last seen at his home in Edinburgh on Wednesday night, and officers have been unable to confirm any potential sightings. Hundreds of members of the public have joined the search.
We still do not know what happened to this three-year-old boy who has went missing.
Nothing will stop me being back out here tomorrow. I'll stay as long as I can tonight. Another few hours at least.
Ed Miliband says he'll break up the banking monopoly if he wins the next election. The Labour leader claimed